Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And this time we're going to bring you an interview with Edward Ashton, author of Mickey 7. So that should be cool, huh?
Yeah.
Totally.
So this is a follow-up episode to where we talked about Mickey 12 plus or minus 5.
Right. Right. Exactly. Mickey's, yeah, I think I called it plus or minus 10 just because we kept saying it. but yes, so I will send you over to ourselves in the past. There we go. I knew I didn't even have to ask. So we're delighted to be joined by Edward Ashton, author of Mickey 7. Hi there, Edward. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. So I've read a couple of places, like bits about your background, and I found a sort of not conflicting, but like I've heard that you're an engineer, that you're a cancer researcher and an author. So tell us about that.
I mean, all three of those things are true.
All right.
I've had a pretty varied career, I guess. I have a doctorate in electrical engineering focused in medical imaging. I got that at the University of Rochester. So that's the engineer part. After I completed my doctorate, I worked for the federal government for a few years, doing stuff I'm basically not allowed to talk about. And then I founded a biotech company called Virtualscopics. That happened in 2000. And I've been doing that for 25 years now. We are focused primarily on cancer research. I do other kinds of biomedical research as well. We do work with neurological diseases, morphological diseases. We did some work with like Zepbound, the obesity drugs that are out there now. We did some of the preliminary work on those. On those drugs. So that's sort of my day job. I write books. That's my side hustle.
Nice. I mean, it sounds like a pretty involved day job. So I'm curious how you find the time to write. Is it just right. your leisure activity?
That's a question I get a lot. I have a family. Mm-hmm. I've been pretty involved with my family and my kids. And you're right. It's not an undemanding job for sure. But I think everyone has little superpowers, right? Everybody's brain works differently. I'm a firm believer that we all have basically the same sort of mental capacity. I don't really believe in like smart people and less smart people. I think we've all got the same 3 pounds of meat in our skulls. it's just allocated to different tasks. And when you see somebody who's really good at one thing, they probably get a big deficit someplace else as a result. Because they've allocated a chunk of their brain to that task that could be doing something else. And one of the things that I am really good at and that has been, sort of my superpower throughout my career, both in writing and in other places, is I'm really good at switching focus. I can be working on something. I can be taking a conference call with some scientist from Buenos Aires about some drug that we've been working on and hang up that call. And I've got 15 minutes and I can open up my laptop and remember exactly where I was 12 hours ago when I left off on a sentence. Wow. Remember exactly where the flow was going, bang out 300 words in that 15 minutes, and then pick up my next call and be ready to go for that. My first novel was basically written with a sandwich in one hand and typing with the other hand, eating lunch at work. And what I found is that if you can work in that way in 15, 20, 30 minute chunks, where time pops up throughout the course of your day, those words add up, right? 200 words here, 300 words there. I see people talking, I know a lot of writers. I hear people say, I had a 15,000 word day. I have never had anything close to a 15,000 word day. I've never written more than 1,000 words in any given day in my entire life. But I have written a complete novel every year for the last 5 years, which I think is something that not that many people can say. Because I'm consistent and I'm persistent and I write every day more or less, and it may not be a ton of words, but 500, 600, 700 words a day, if you do it every single day, adds up to a novel in about 7 months. And then you throw in the editing time, and every January I turn in a new book and my publisher's happy and my agent's happy and I'm happy too. And my family's happy because I'm not taking 3 hours at a time away from them to go like lock myself in a room, tippy tap on a keyboard. I'm doing this work when I would be, playing words with friends or something. I'm taking away time from things that I probably shouldn't be doing anyway, to do more useful work. So that's how I manage it.
Yeah, that's inspiring, actually. I mean, that's kind of the way people sometimes ask. I read a lot of books, probably not as many as you. people ask me, you know, how do you read so fast? And I say, I don't read that fast. I just read consistently. And yeah. And so if you do it every day, it adds up. Cool.
Yeah. So you first got published in 2014.
It depends on what you consider first got published. My first professional sale was in 1989. My first publication was in the newsletter of an Italian sausage company.
I was going to ask about this. I saw that on your website.
I got paid $100 and a 3-foot by 3-foot sheet pizza. That was my payment. I still consider it one of my best paydays ever. Absolutely fantastic. Really, really top-notch pizza. I learned later, and this is something that your listeners probably should be aware of too, money can be exchanged for goods and services. So if you get paid in money, you can actually get all the pizza you want. I was not aware of that at the time. I learned that later on. That's one of those little tips that they don't teach you at the beginning of your writing career. I wrote more exclusively for places that paid in cash rather than food later on. But between then and about 1996, I published a pile of short stories in different magazines, different places. Developed a little bit of a reputation, I think. One of my stories wound up in the MFA program curriculum for the University of Vermont. I was pretty excited about that. And then I had my first kid, and I did not have the will at that point or the time to sit over a keyboard for any time at all, because I had this little person and then two and then three of them who actually wanted to spend time with me and thought I was neat and fun. And I did not write a word for 14 years.
Wow.
I completely stopped writing. And then at some point, and this was also a big surprise to me, I learned that teenagers do not think their dads are the coolest person in the world. And suddenly I had some more time on my hands again, and I picked it up again. And that was about 2012, 2013. And 6 months after that, I had the draft of my first novel. And then I descended into the querying swamps, which many writers are familiar with. It took me 32 queries before I got a yes, before someone agreed to represent me. That's my agent, Paul Lucas, who I've been with for the last 11 years now. I thought that was a lot at the time. I've since learned that 32 queries is not a lot, actually. Some people go through hundreds and hundreds of queries and never get to yes. So I feel very, very fortunate in the way that all worked out. But yeah, then my first novel was published in 2015. And that was 3 days in April.
Wow. Wow. So I do a lot of the research for the podcast. And according to the ISFDB website, your first publication was in 2014. So I'm going to have to go do some back research and find your other publications and add them to there.
I mean, if you want to do back research, all you got to do is go to my website. It's all there.
Okay, cool.
Just nice. Check out easy the links. Peasy.
So, cool.
Yeah.
Good to have an easy source for that kind of thing. So do you have any, I just kind of general nerdery kind of questions. Like, do you have favorite science fiction books, movies, authors?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a voracious reader. I have been for forever. I started digging through science fiction novels. My dad was a big fan of science fiction, and I started pulling books off his shelf when I was probably 5 or 6 years old. A lot of books that I probably shouldn't have been reading at that age, if I'm being completely honest with you. There's some of these books that I remember really fondly, and I'll go back and reread them later. I've reread them as an adult, and like, wow, I didn't get that. And I'm really glad I didn't get that, because my 8-year-old self could not have been reading this. Holy crap.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of readers or authors who have really influenced me over the years, I always first say Kurt Vonnegut. I've read every word that Kurt Vonnegut has ever written, and there are a lot of them, most of them 2, 3, 4 times. There's one entire segment at the end of Cat's Cradle that I had memorized word for word for a while. I don't think I could recite the entire bit now. But there's this, I don't know if you're familiar with the book or not.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now.
Okay. Yes. I'm not going to spoil it for you.
Okay.
But there's a scene at the end on a mountaintop with a girl that just the first time I read it hit me literally doubled me over like a punch in the gut. And I have never forgotten it. And I've always wanted to be able to write a scene with that kind of power. And I don't know if I've ever succeeded in doing that, but that's one of my goals as a writer.
Cool.
In terms of science fiction, you know, pure science fiction authors, people like Clifford D. Simak, George R. R. Martin in his early days, not so much in his Sword and Sorcery days, but when he was writing hard science fiction, I really liked some of his early work. David Brin, who you mentioned, I've always been a big fan of Brin, Werner Vinge, people like that. You know, I really consider sort of foundational to my work.
Nice. Do you like to write in that more hard science fiction space?
I mean, I like to write. I try not to limit myself. You know, I mentioned I had sort of a stretch as a short story writer, primarily in the early 90s. That was all actually literary, kind of contemporary literary short fiction that I was writing at that time. I've written some fantasy. Most of my work right now is more sort of, I wouldn't say completely hard science fiction. I'm not someone who is really interested in teaching you about tech. That's not my thing. There are other authors out there who do that and do it way better than me. I like reading that stuff sometimes. I don't like writing it. I write character focused fiction, and whatever background I put behind those characters doesn't really matter so much to me. It's the interactions between the characters and sort of their emotions and their relationships to one another that's important to me. That's what I really try to get at in my work.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. On another podcast that I'm on, we review in December and January a magazine from a certain number of decades ago and then a current one. And Analog in this last January's magazine had an article all about relativistic warfare between solar systems. And it was an odd thing to read in a science fiction magazine because it was pretty cold-blooded. But I was interested to see that show up in Mickey 7.
I was going to say, yeah, it relates.
Yeah, it related really well.
That's something that has spooked me for a long time. I've got a background in physics, so I kind of have a feel for how these things work. And I'm not familiar with the article that you're referring to, but I assume what they're talking about is the idea that if it is possible, we don't know if it's possible or not at this point, but if it's possible to accelerate a macro object to something close to the speed of light, you have now basically an undefendable weapon. An object of, you know, 50 kilograms moving at 99% of the speed of light has enough energy to crack a planet open like an eggshell. Mm-hmm. And moreover, it can't be defended against because the light announcing its arrival shows up a millionth of a second before the object itself. So there's no way to even know it's coming before it hits. And so as a result, and this is one of the explanations for Fermi's paradox, why do we not see anyone? Why don't we hear anyone out there? If that sort of thing is possible, then, and again, I wonder if you said really cold-blooded. I wonder if the Analog article mentioned this. Game theory says if you detect any other species out there that has a technological basis, you have to destroy it because otherwise it can destroy you and there's nothing you can do about it. And you don't know. They could be good. They could be bad. They could be indifferent. But to protect yourself, the only way to protect yourself is to kill them first. And so if that is true, if it is possible to do that physically, then the only species we should expect to see out there are ones that are keeping quiet and staying hidden. Or the one that's going around doing the killing.
Right.
That's the only two species who should be out there. And if the only one surviving, the one's keeping quiet, then we may be in trouble because we haven't been keeping that quiet.
No, we're pretty loud as all things go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, that's kind of the premise behind Contact, right? We've been sending not necessarily our best stuff out there when the first image they send back to us is of Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, maybe they'll forgive us after they get to the point where they can watch I Love Lucy.
Maybe.
It's kind of the irony in the plates on Voyager detailing humans.
Yeah. Here we are. Here's where we are. Right. And here's how to find us.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. How much world building did, like with a novel like Mickey 7, I want to focus more on that obviously because it's the one that's in the news, right? How much actual world building did you do in terms of, I know that some stuff spun out in Antimatter Blues where there was a fact, I think that the kind of human diaspora had been going on for 1,000 years. Like, do you have a big bunch of, like, here's the geography of all the planets and that kind of thing?
No, that's not how I work. Okay. Everything lives in my head. Mm. I know, like I said, I know a lot of authors and we all work in different ways. I have a friend who does, before she'll even start on a project, she does what she calls her book Bible. And she'll write 300, 400 pages just of like lore and background and mapping out the civilization she's writing about and everything. And she'll spend 6 months, 8 months, a year working on that book Bible before she writes a single Dang. Word of the actual book. Mm. I admire that kind of work ethic. I wish I did. I don't even do outlines for books. I've tried to do that too. And I just, when I'm trying to write an outline, everything I come up with just seems stupid to me. Like I can't in that sort of, here's how my plot's going to go. I just can never come up with anything good. You know, it just doesn't work for me. The details of the plot sort of come to me as I'm working. And I think, there's some sort of process going on in my subconscious, in my, you know, in my medulla oblongata or something that's generating these ideas and stringing them together because they all make sense at the end. You know, I've written 7 books now and they've all got coherent plots and everything links up at the end. So somebody's doing that work, but it's not my thinky brain that's doing that. It's some other part of my brain that's handling that work.
Okay. Because I was wondering when I was reading Antimatter Blues, which I really enjoyed as well, which if anybody doesn't know is the sequel to Mickey 7, I wondered if some of the tidbits in there were things that occurred to you while you were writing Mickey 7, but you realized we don't need that in this book.
No, I know the sort of bits and pieces you're thinking of, but those are pieces that came to me as I was writing Antimatter Blues.
Okay.
To say, man, I wish I had thought of this when I was writing Mickey 7. This, okay, because... Like I see how things fit together in the book. And then as I'm writing Antimatter Blues, I see, oh, this is the piece that makes piece A to fit to piece C. Here's piece B. And I describe it here. Mm-hmm. But that piece B was not apparent to me when I was writing Mickey 7, because I didn't need it to be.
Right.
Right. And I needed it when I was writing Antimatter Blues. And so it sort of comes to me. And again, it all fits together. It all fits together at the end of the day. So somebody was figuring all that stuff out. It just was not my conscious brain that was doing it. Mm.
Nice. We mentioned when we were doing our episode about Mickey 7 and the movie that I had caught a couple of the literary references in there. And I mentioned the one about the Princess Bride. When I originally reached out to you, that was really, even if you weren't going to come on, I just wanted to know, was that really a Princess Bride reference? So that was cool.
Yeah. I actually I had somebody send me a nasty gram right after the book was published.
Oh, really?
he said, you know, I was reading your book and I was enjoying it. And then I got to the start of this chapter and you just stole this line from The Princess Bride. You are a plagiarist. And I will never read another.
Oh my God!
It's a callback, wow. My man. It's a callback. We do this. We bounce things off of each other as authors, as artists. This is what we do. Right. It's not plagiarism. Yeah. It is a callback.
Yeah.
Because that Princess Bride is my all time favorite film. It's also one of my it's one of the few book movie combinations where I think they're both just outstanding. Mm. Like the book is fantastic. The movie is also equally fantastic. And I really can't say which one I like more. I love them both. And so I do put little shout outs to that. That's not the only place that a shout out to The Princess Bride has showed up in one of my books. I will tell you that. That book and that movie live rent free in my brain and have since like 1986.
Yeah. 100%. The other thing we noticed was the planet Galt.
Yeah. John Galt references right there.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a loving reference to Atlas Shrugged.
No, it is not. Yeah, I'm not subtle about that particular about that particular reference or sort of my opinion of
it kind of just falls apart.
And Rand's philosophical ideas. I'm not a huge fan.
Yeah. I got that.
Yep.
One thing that stuck out to me in Mickey 7 that I don't think really translated to the movie, and we're not necessarily switching over to talk about the movie at this point, but the fact that the Mickeys were just starving the whole book. Yeah. I could feel that, like, that they're just both of them are just I need food, I need food. And the fact that most of the food that they get, and I love the idea of the exchange rate for different foods being different. And so Cycler Paste was the one where you could really maximize your food dollar, food credit. But the idea of Cycler Paste is just, It's really gross. But like the fact that somebody is starving so much that this is just what they're going to eat.
Being hungry is a big issue for me, and it always has been. I grew up without a lot of material resources. I'm from West Virginia. I grew up in a small town in West Virginia. My dad was a jazz musician, which I don't know if you know a lot about the economics of jazz musicians in South Central West Virginia, but it's not a super lucrative trade. And you know, I had three siblings and a fast metabolism, and I was an athlete, I was a swimmer and a runner, so I was burning off a ton of calories all the time, and I was hungry all the time. And that went through right to college. You know, my first semester of college, I ran through my entire meal plan by October. I literally was hanging around the pizza shop on campus at closing time, and they would give me the freaking dog from Lady and the Tramp, and they would like give me the extra pieces slices because they felt sorry for me, and you know, outside the place. So that's something that shows up in my work. I think a lot of writers write their own kind of obsessions. And that's definitely one for me.
That's why you ended up working for pizza.
it does show up in the movie. You know, director Bong does sort of, you don't notice it as much because you're not as much inside Mickey's head as you are in the book. Mm-hmm. But like there's a scene in the cafeteria right at the beginning where Nasha gives him some of her food, right? Mm-hmm. And because his plate is empty. Kat at one point in the cafeteria also, like, here, you must be hungry, take some more food. There's the dinner scene with Marshall where he just like comedically shoves this gross raw whatever it is down his throat, mm-hmm. and can't even stop long enough to have a conversation. So it's in there, but you're not getting his internal dialogue or monologue as you are in the book. So it's not as in your face, I guess.
We didn't really talk about the cycler paste and like, would you eat it?
It depends. How chalky is it? How gritty is it?
The closest analog I could think of was when I was in Tokyo one time and went out for a work dinner, and they just ordered everything. Occasionally we'd point to something on the menu. They'd be like, Westerners don't really like that. We're like, okay, spare us that one. But one thing that we got was this massive, just big, I don't even know how to describe it, a mountain of silken tofu that was really soft, like like Greek yogurt. Kind of thing. And then, you know, it was covered with like these sort of fried leeks or something.
Okay.
But you know, the tofu itself, you know, it has virtually no flavor. And so you'd kind of take it with your chopsticks and then put some soy sauce on it in order to give it some semblance of flavor.
If you want to know where cycler paste comes from specifically, there is a product called Unimix, which the United Nations, I don't think they use it anymore, but in the 1980s and 90s, they distributed this to places which were being hit by famine, where people were in the end stages of starvation. Because when you go into the end stages of starvation, you lose the ability to digest a lot of food.
Yeah.
Your body quits making the enzymes you need to digest food. And so Unimix was a mix of olive oil, some finely ground flour, and egg protein. And they'd mix it with river water and make this gray sort of tasteless paste. Mm. And it was something that was supposed to be, you don't even need to digest it. Basically, it can just be absorbed by your intestines and provide sustenance to these people who are starving. Mm. But it's, you know, just the most repulsive thing you can imagine kind of putting into your mouth. It'll keep you alive, but you might kind of wish that you weren't.
Right.
And that's exactly what I was thinking of when I came up with the idea of cycler paste. That's the product that I was basing it on.
Wow.
Gotcha.
I was kind of pictured it the same way as the breakfast food from The Matrix.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a single cell protein. Yeah. Yeah. Cream of wheat.
It was portrayed in the film, by the way.
Yeah.
I really like this sort of gun that squirts out this gray goop. That's
right.
That's pretty much what I was thinking of. So he really kind of nailed it there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one thing that he really got right very much on the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yummy.
One thing that I think is interesting about Mickey 7 is that, you know, the hero of the story is not exactly Johnny Squarejaw, right? He's not like this hyper competent guy who can do anything. That's Berto, right? Who maybe not the best guy in the world, but he's very competent at whatever he tries to do. Where Mickey, a little more of a screw up, you know, finds himself in this situation because of misadventure and not realizing that Berto is an amazing specimen.
Right. Yeah, I read a what I thought was a really perceptive review of my new book, The Fourth Consort, and it talked about the hero of that book or the protagonist of that book, Dalton Greaves, as, and this is in caps, just some guy trademark, and referred to that this is like my, this is Ashton's absolute favorite thing, is to produce a hero who is just some guy TM. and you know what, that there's something to that. There's something to that. I don't like the sort of chosen one kind of trope. I don't want to write about somebody who has special powers, who's really great at everything, you know, who's been selected to be the one to save the world. I don't really believe in those people. I think people who step up and do great things are typically just some guy TM yeah. who happened to be in the right place and willing to step up to do it. And that's the kind of characters that because if you've got superpowers, if you're like Superman or whatever, what's the virtue in what you're doing? It's easy for you.
Yeah.
Right. What's interesting to me and what's virtuous to me is doing something, even though it's really hard, even though you're not really suited for it, but you step up and you do it anyway. And that's the kind of characters I try to write.
Mm. It's like, there's no sacrifice or stakes in the game, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want somebody to be OP, right?
It's boring.
Like, that's me. Like Captain Marvel and Superman, I always thought were boring because like, what, you can't fight them. Like they're invulnerable. They can like lift an entire planet with one hand. And it's like, what's the point?
I think just some guy is more relatable too. To a broader audience, I would say. Yeah. So that's cool.
Yeah. Kind of like Steve Rogers pre-serum.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I like, you know, that also gives him some room for growth across the series, because mm-hmm. Antimatter Blues, he kind of has to take on an actual leadership role he's kind of forced into. And I really enjoyed that book just kind of for the direction it took some of the characters.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have growth. You have to have character development through the arc of the story. And I definitely try to do that. I want him to be a better person at the end than he was at the beginning. And I feel like I got there with Mickey.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, if he's already great at the beginning, it's really hard to do that.
Hard to go up from there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I did like how he rediscovers himself as a historian, I guess, right? He didn't really value himself as a historian until he had to dig into the history of all the things he was doing and analyze the data and learn and become a better person.
that was another sort of nasty gram I got after Mickey 7 was published. Somebody wrote this long yelling email at me that I had written this book saying that the humanities are worthless and that, you know, we should all just be tech bros. Like, you didn't read the book.
I think
you
missed the point.
That's the whole point. He's devalued by society, but it turns out that's exactly the skill they need. They're mm-hmm. in so mm-hmm. much trouble because nobody understands or remembers history. That's right. The whole point.
Mm-hmm. But, exactly.
You know, every book is a conversation between the author and the reader. And sometimes, you know, we're talking past each other, and that's okay too, I guess.
Yeah. 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 Well, we're all engineers. So
yeah. I double majored in engineering and writing, which is, I think it's an unusual combo. There's not a lot of overlaps in the programs. There's not a lot of classes that satisfy both.
Yeah.
So that's not too many people go that route, I think.
So one of the other things that I really enjoyed about Mickey 7 in terms of how it's crafted is the inclusion of the kind of, they're not really twin ideas, but two sides of a coin, right? The natalists and the ghost chasers, where you have, you know, who could imagine a religious sect emerging to oppose something scientific?
Never happened. I don't know what you're talking about.
Crazy, right? I mean, that's why I'm a science fiction writer. I think of impossible things that could never happen in real life.
Yes. Yeah. So. Yeah. And then the other side of that is, of course, the weird sex thing that develops about this scientific thing. So.
And isn't that exactly what would happen?
Yes.
I feel like that was the most inevitable part of the entire book, was that weird sex thing would come up around it. I mean, that's just kind of who we are as a species. Mm-hmm.
So. How did Mickey 7 come to be, the book?
So Mickey 7 actually began in 2015. It started with an image. And a lot of my books, a lot of my short stories start with just an image that gets stuck in my head. And in this particular case, that image was of a man at the bottom of a crevasse, injured and freezing and trapped. And I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know who he was or where. I didn't know if this was on Earth or someplace else. I didn't know if this was present or future or past. But just this seemed like a really bad position to be in, and therefore really interesting to me, because as an author, I'm also a sadist, and I like to put my characters in really awful positions. And so I noodled on it for a while, and that image was kind of sticking with me. And so I thought, you know, maybe I'll write a little bit about this. So I wrote about 500 words that were really just his internal monologue about what he was doing there. And then I was trying to think, well, why isn't anyone helping him? And that's when I brought Birdo in, and I added in a little dialogue between the two of them. And Birdo wouldn't come help him. And I'm like, why won't he's supposed to be his friend. Why won't his friend come help him? And that's when I came up with the idea of the expendable. Oh, because he's an expendable. That's why Birdo won't help him. That's why he's trapped there. That's why he's stuck. And so it's really just a process of me figuring out what was going on with this guy. And then of course I had to have him have somewhere to go from the bottom of this crevasse. I couldn't just leave him there to die. That's a really bad story.
So it's a very short story.
So there's got to be some tunnels for him to kind of wander into. And then there's got to be something bad in those tunnels. Because again, sadist. And that's when the creepers came into the story. And eventually I had about 3,000, 4,000 words, which are now basically the first chapter of the book. And I thought it was going to be a short story. I got to the end of it. The end of that was when the creepers shove him out into the snow. And then I thought, you know, there's not really an ending. It's not an ending. It's not a complete story. There's no arc here. I better keep going. and so I thought, well, maybe this is actually a novella. So I kept writing and I wound up with 25,000 words. And it was, at that point, I had a complete story, but it was really dark and it was really weird. And also novellas are really hard to sell. And at this point, my agent had gotten it in front of Nava Wolf, who was an editor of Penguin at the time. And she actually liked it. I don't know if you know Nava or have heard of her before. She's a pretty well-known editor. And he got me on the phone with her and we talked it through. And she's like, look, I like some of the ideas you've thrown out here. I like the dialogue. It's snappy. I like the characters. But like, I can't publish a novella because nobody buys novellas. Can you make it a novel? I was like, you know? Yeah, I think I can. And so I went back and I reworked it and added some additional sort of plot filigrees. And by December of 2019, I had the draft of the book, which was basically the draft that exists in published form today. I turned it into my agent in December of 2019. Warner Brothers optioned it 24 days later. Ask me. Yeah, exactly. Wow. That's not how that's supposed to work, right? And things have sort of gone from there.
So do you know how it got to Bong Joon-ho?
Yes, I do, actually. So what happened was that my agent got it in the hands of a book scout who got it in the hands of the folks at Plan B Productions, which is Jeremy Kleiner, Dee Dee Gardner, and Brad Pitt's production company. And they had worked with Bong Joon-ho previously on Okja. And so they had a pre-existing relationship with him. And Jeremy, in particular, I think after reading the book, saw some commonalities maybe between my style, my sense of humor, I think, and Director Bong. And having gotten a chance to spend some time with Director Bong now, I think there's a lot to that. I think he and I see the world in very similar ways. I think we're really compatible in the way that we see things from a sort of political social commentary standpoint, from a dark humor standpoint, from a love of absurdity standpoint. I think there's a lot of linkages there. And Jeremy told me, you know, after reading this, he's like, Director Bong is the only person who can direct this. And so we really need to get him involved. So he had me write a letter to Director Bong, telling him sort of what my hopes were for this book, what I was trying to communicate with this book, how much I thought it sort of jived with his sensibilities. And for whatever reason, you know, Director Bong, who of course had just come off Parasite, winning a bunch of Oscars and was kind of on top of the world, decided, you know, despite the fact that everybody in the world is throwing projects at me and say, do this, this book by this unknown mid-list author. Yeah, this is it. This is what I want to do.
Hmm.
And how exactly that thought process went, I don't know, and I'll never know. It is beyond absurd. I've said this before, but it, you know, if I wrote this kind of plot line into one of my books, I get laughed out of my editor's office. But I haven't ruled out the possibility that I might actually be in an intensive care ward right now on heavy drip morphine, and my wife's just about to pull the plug out of the wall. If so, I'm glad she waited till I got to see the movie before she did it. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, thank you for letting us share this time with you. Then
you're more than welcome. More than welcome to existence and my delusions. So yes. You know, enjoy the time while you've got it. I guess when she pulls the plug, you're all gone too. Then.
Yep, I guess so.
That's bad. How will we know if it's pulling the plug or if it's the near relativistic weapon? Right. I guess we won't know.
Yep.
Potato, potato. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
So was it like some authors like to write. Some authors like to see their works be adapted. Was that a big thing for you one way or the other? Is it a cool thing that happened? A coincidental thing that happened?
Oh, obviously I'm absolutely thrilled that all this has occurred. But for me, the big thing is that having the exposure that a movie project gives you has allowed me to get my work in front of a lot more eyes than it ever would have before. I mean, if you write a book and it's a New York Times bestseller, you're selling maybe 75,000 copies a month, right? That's about the rate that'll get you, depending on the month and depending on what else is going on, that'll get you to the top of the New York Times list. If a movie doesn't sell, you know, 20 million tickets in the first week, it's a flop, right? The number of people that will see a movie, even like a mid-range movie versus a runaway bestseller book, is exponentially higher.
Yeah.
And so by getting your work in that format, you are getting your ideas, you're getting your work out in front of just many more people, many more eyes than you ever could just with a book. So, you know, I was thrilled about that. Obviously, you know, there are financial benefits to being involved in a movie that far exceed what you can get with a novel. Again, because there's so much more money in the movie business than there is in the book writing business. That's just, you know, sort of basic economics. So the whole thing was fantastic. I've had people ask me, like, are you nervous? Are you afraid of handing your baby over to, you know, so they can do whatever they want with it? Like, are you absolutely out of your mind? Saying my this sort of obscure author, afraid that Bong Joon-ho, the world's most famous director, is going to do something bad to my... No. That's like the fact that you're asking that question makes me think that you haven't really thought this through, right? No, I was never concerned about that at all.
Nice. Were you involved at all in the screenwriting process, or is that completely out of your hands?
My sole involvement in the screenwriting process was... I had right after Director Bong signed on to the project, I had about a 2-hour Zoom call with him, where he wanted to talk through aspects of the book with me. This was well before the book was ever published. He had received a PDF of it. He printed it out and illustrated it himself.
Wow.
He's an artist. He does cool. All of his own storyboards. It was really impressive. And so he's sort of holding these illustrations up to the camera and
nice.
Asking me, like, is this what you thought this looked like? Is this what you thought a creeper looked like? What is it? You know, how big is this dome? How far is it from here to Earth? And just like digging into the tiny, tiny details of a lot of things that I had never even thought of, that I had never considered myself. And sort of midway through the project, through this call, I think I started to get the feeling, I think he also started to get the feeling that, you know what, maybe we're seeing this project in the same way. Maybe this is something we want to move forward with. My daughter, who was at the time was getting ready to apply to veterinary school, was sitting downstairs. This was during COVID. So our whole family was all crammed into the house together. And she immediately ran over to my other daughter's room. And I didn't know what she was doing because I was immersed in this call. But what she did was she ran over to my other daughter's room, burst in and said, I'm going to vet school for free. This was actually going to happen. And, you know, she's right. The amount of money that Warner Brothers paid for me, they might as well have just signed that check directly to Long Island veterinary school, because that is exactly where it wound up going.
Excellent.
Awesome. But there was a point in the conversation where he said to me, look, when we move forward with this, I'm going to be writing a 120-page script. You have written a 350-page novel. Mm-hmm. You can see right away, there's right. stuff that's not going to fit in here. Lots mm-hmm. of stuff can have to get thrown out. And also, I have my, he called it bong sauce. Yeah. He says, like, I have my own stuff that I want to put in here that's not in your book. So that's going to crowd out even more. So I want you to tell me, what is the one thing in this book that if it's not there, it won't be your story anymore? What is the heart of this book? And whatever that is, I promise you, I will put that in my movie. And I will tell you, he did not have to do that. When they've optioned your work, it is 100% their property and they can do whatever they could just take the title and throw everything else away if they want to. Yeah. They can twist it around in any way they want. This was a kindness that was offered from him to me. And I say this to everyone who will listen. Director Bong is one of the kindest, warmest, most genuine people I have ever met. He's absolutely a fantastic human being. And I will be forever grateful for the way that he worked with me on this project. Because again, he could have just taken it, ignored me, and done his own thing and just done exactly what he wanted. And so I thought about it for about 2 seconds and I said, chapter 19 has got to be in there. And he said, I'm so glad you said that. I cried when I read that chapter. I was going to put it in anyway. And I said, can I pick something else? And he said, no. And that was the end of my involvement in the script writing process. Mm. Next thing I saw about it was a year and a half later when I was actually on set and they gave me a copy of the script, made me sign an NDA to see it, which basically said, if any information from that script ever was divulged and it could be traced back to me, I owed them $5,000 for every individual who saw that information, which means basically if something got out on the internet, I owe them all the money on earth and they could chop me right. up into organ meat and sell me to a cat food right. factory. Yeah. One of the scariest NDAs I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen a lot of NDAs.
So then you end up the crew expendable on a mission.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's pretty much where I would be. When I actually got to see the script as a finished product, that was the next thing that I knew about it. I had no involvement from that call to the point when they were already in the middle of filming. I had no involvement or understanding what was going on at all.
So I don't have a copy of the book in front of me, but just from things that you've said about the way you like to kind of tell your story through characters, I have to imagine chapter 19 was something about Mickey and Nasha.
Yeah. Chapter 19 is, it's a short chapter that's about the medical experiments, the mm-hmm. deaths of Mickey 3, 4, and 5 in quick succession, mm-hmm. where, and you see this in the film mm-hmm. toward the end, where Nasha bullies her way into going into the isolation tank with Mickey, right. and she's cradling him in her arms as he dies.
Yeah.
And that's because to me, you know, there are philosophical elements to this book, there are science fiction elements to this book, but at the end of the day, like I said, I write about characters and their relationships, and that relationship is what this book is about. This is about Mickey and Nasha and the fact that this is a really strange and strained love and relationship because, you know, Mickey dies repeatedly and Nasha has to watch that. Mm-hmm. And she feels it every time that he dies, just like he does. And she stays and she loves him anyway. And as they sort of say in the film, she loves every aspect of him, even when he's, you know, a little bit of a different person from incarnation to incarnation. She loves him anyway.
Yeah.
And he loves her through all of it. And he does what he can to protect her. You know, the opening scene of the book, he's trapped at the bottom of his crevasse. She wants to come save him and he won't let her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because he can come back and she can't. And then she saves him at other points in, you know, particularly in Antimatter Blue, she becomes almost his protector.
Yes.
And that relationship is the one that had to come through. And that 100% is there in the film. Just sort of details different, but in spirit, exactly the way I wrote it in the book. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think the thing the movie does most right is get that relationship right. And I'll say 100%. For people who haven't read Antimatter Blues, that really is the strength of it is that you almost kind of flip the script at some point in Antimatter Blues where he's having to take care of her and seeing her in that kind of extremity. And so, yeah, really, really good.
Wow. So I'm guessing that director Bong Sauce is not pureed Creeper Tales. What would you say that director Bong Sauce is? What special thing did he bring to the movie that you really love?
So he took a lot of the things that I wrote in Shades of Gray and he turned them into sort of vivid color. He made everything more kinetic. He made everything more visual, which is what you have to do to successfully adapt a sort of a thinky book to more of an action film. So, you know, one great example is when Mickey first realizes that he's become a multiple, right? What the hell are we going to do? Like, if they find out that we're a multiple, that we're dead. That whole sequence is basically worked out in the book as a conversation. In the movie, it's a fist fight. Right. Like, you know, flying dumbbells and I'm going to kill you and like shoving each other down the corpse hole. It's the same scene at heart and accomplishes the same thing in moving the plot forward in the movie and the book. But in the movie, it is much more vivid. It is more kinetic. And again, that, I don't think that's better or worse. It's how you have to accomplish something on the screen when you can't see inside the character's head.
Yeah.
You know, when you can get inside the character's head, you can do other things in terms of like the turmoil that's happening inside while the outside is calm. In a movie, the outside can't be calm. And it is definitely not. I also really like the pigeon. I like the pigeon guy. I thought he was a fun addition. When I first saw the trailer, that was the first I did a social media post, and it was just like, I love this, but what the hell's up with the pigeon? And I found out later what the hell was up with the pigeon. And I thought it was a really nice addition. I wish I had thought to put the pigeon in the book. I think it would have been fun. Hmm. So
one of the things that I really love about the book is that, you know, obviously cloning and consciousness download kind of stuff always is going to bring up that, are we the same person thing? And I love that in the book, you just front load that conversation. Like the first chapter, he's talking about the ship of Theseus.
You know, you would think it would always bring up that consciousness question, but it doesn't. Mm. It doesn't always. You know, like Star Trek. The transporter beam.
Right.
They never even think about it. They just like hop on the transporter beam and go. They don't seem to care. I would be thinking about that if I were one of them. Mm-hmm. Like the first time you test that thing out, it scans your whole body, right? And then we reconstruct you on the other side and they call back and say, okay, he came through. Dissolve the guy you got on your end. Like, can you jump in the ass back? Because I don't. Yeah. I don't get that ass back.
Yep.
They don't seem to think about that at all in Star Trek.
Flies in there with you. And right.
I wrote an essay right after the book came out for a publication. They asked me to do this where I looked at a half a dozen other books that had sort of similar themes about cloning and having multiple versions of yourself hanging around. And the majority of them didn't actually wrestle with this question at all. The one that did, that I thought handled really well, was a short story from, I want to say like 1986, called Think Like a Dinosaur, which is, and if you're interested in reading a really interesting philosophical like look at this question, I highly recommend that piece. The other one is Clifford D. Simak's story, Goodnight, Mr. James, also addressed this in a really, really thoughtful way. But a lot of the other books and shows that I surveyed, certainly in that essay, just sort of took it for granted that, yeah, you're just the same person. It's just like a means of immortality.
Yeah. But even talking about Clifford Simak, the way station, I think that the guy mans that teleportation portal and he has to get rid of the dead body now that's left behind.
Yeah. He gave some thought to that question. But a lot of people don't. And again, I think it comes down to the question of do you believe that all we are is this summation of sort of electrical impulses going on inside 3 pounds of meat inside our skulls.
Right.
And if that's what you believe all of our thoughts and hopes and dreams are, then reproducing that in some other format is going to be the exact same person. Sure. Absolutely. Because it's just some pattern of electrical signals. If you believe there's something more to us, some sort of ineffable essence that is me and that will never be reproduced and that has never been on this planet before and never will be again, then you're not going to believe that reproduced version of you is actually you. And it's a philosophical question that can't really be answered.
Yeah.
And I think we all have to come up with an answer for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny you bring that up because we decided to pursue this as a podcast episode just after talking about The Measure of a Man, the Star Trek Next Generation episode, where that very question comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I mean, we We considered this sort of a diversion off of we were doing a series on robot things, but we're like, you know, expendable workforce is very similar to the questions of robots and RUR, you know, originally it's not, it's not mechanical beings, right? So yeah.
It boils down to that expendable class.
Yeah. Anything else, Colin?
I don't think so.
Well then, kind of before we let you go, you know, Antimatter Blues, I know, is the sequel to Mickey 7. Do you have any plans for further books in the series?
I have plans for books in this series. Whether those plans will ever be realized is not entirely up to me. I actually have put together a treatment for a third book and also for a standalone sort of in the Mickeyverse, but not using these same characters and the same plot, a sort of another book in that space. Whether those books ever get made depends on whether my publisher ever decides that they want to publish those books.
Yeah.
The last, as we go through, I sort of sign contracts. I've been signing 2-book contracts as we've gone. And each time I sort of pitch a number of different ideas and they sort of pick out, well, we'd really like this one and this one. And they've been leaning more towards standalones recently, which is totally fine. I like doing standalones. My most recent book, Mal Goes to War, which came out a little over a year ago. And then this book, The Fourth Consort, which just came out recently. And then After the Fall, which is my next book, which comes out in January 2026. Those are all standalones. But I would like to at some point come back to this space, but it really depends on whether I'm getting the support for that from my publisher and from the other folks that work with me.
Okay. I just got the audiobook for Mal Goes to War from our library and I was listening to it today and it has oculars in it. It made me think, is this in the Mickeyverse?
No, I just like to reuse some of the same technology because I think it's neat.
It's very neat. Yeah.
So yeah, it's the oculars are used very differently in Mal Goes to War than they are in the Mickeyverse though. Mm-hmm. So it's
You have a non-human main character too. So
yes. Yeah. Which makes a big difference.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, then, I mean, you've already mentioned a couple of your subsequent novels. So if people have come to you through Mickey 7, you know, give us a pitch, a quick rundown of the more recent novels.
So the most recent one is The Fourth Consort. This, don't tell Director Bong, please, but I really feel like it's my best work. I'm really excited about this book. It plays with some tropes of science fiction and sort of turns them on their head, which is something that I like to do. In particular, I'm looking at this idea that you see in a lot of sort of like 70s and 80s science fiction, where there's this benevolent society of species out there, right? And sort of working for the good of all life. And they invite us humans to come join this great galactic civilization. In my book, I ask the question, okay, well, what if that happens, but we find out later that the group that invited us to join actually is more of a criminal gang. And there really is a benevolent galactic civilization out there, and it hates us. And it hates the group that we signed on with, but now it's too late. We've already signed up, and we're kind of stuck, and we've signed on with the wrong team, basically. So my protagonist also is sort of a fun science fiction trope that maybe was a little more popular in the 70s. Alice Sheldon used to really love working with characters like this, which I refer to as the hyper-competent broken man. You know, you talk about Mickey being sort of like a skillless schlub. This guy, Dalton Greaves, he's got a lot of skills. He's a military veteran. He was a war hero. He was a sort of a tech guy. He founded he worked with a biotech company and was really successful. And then his life got completely thrown off the rails. He had a tragedy that struck him in his life. And when we meet him in the book, he's basically an alcoholic, unemployed sort of loser living in a small town in West Virginia. I really liked those characters when I read them when I was younger, and I wanted to see what I could do with one. And I really like where he wound up and how he winds up developing, sort of following a really nice redemption arc, which is something that I think, you know, we can all get behind.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah. I love a redemption story.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
That actually kind of reminds me of the main character from John Scalzi's book, Fuzzy Nation.
I have not read that. But it wasn't that, that wasn't that a rewrite of a book from the, I want to say, 70s or the 80s?
Yeah, a little fuzzy.
So that would track. That would track with that, because, like mm-hmm. I said, that's a character like Bryn used to write characters like, if in the Uplift universe, Bryn has a character like that. Werner Vinge had a character like that in A Deepness in the Sky. Like I said, Al Sheldon, James Tiptree Jr. used to love writing characters like that. So it's a type that I always admired, and I had never tried to write one before. And so I'm really pleased with the way it came out.
Cool. I'm gonna have to pick that up then.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, Edward, thank you so much for doing this. And where can people find you?
You can find me on pretty much all social media at Ed Ashton Writing. You can also check in on my website, which is edwardashton.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right.
Yep, have a good one.
Bye.
All right. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Edward. That was a lot of fun. He told us we could call him Ed, but we figured we'd stick with the author name. And definitely recommend that you pick up Mickey 7. Antimatter Blues is also very good. And I'm listening to Mal Goes to War now, and I'm probably going to pick up The Fourth Consort as well.
Nice.
Yeah. And I enjoy
it. Mal Goes to War? M-A-L?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, like malware.
Got it.
Yeah.
Like Captain Mal.
Yep.
No. Yes. Different Mal. But we're going to continue with our robot series with The Wild Robot, which we got to go see at OMSI. And so we'll mm-hmm. tell you more about that next time. Yeah. All right.
Ciao.
Bye, everybody.
Y'all on fire there?
I don't know what that is. I think it's the oven going off.
Is there something in the oven?
Yes.
Okay. Do you need to go check?
No.
It? Okay.
Should be fine.
If I start to see smoke coming out behind you, I'll give you a hint.